I'm Allison Mendel for the defendant, Malcolm Brooks. I'm going to attempt to take only 8 minutes for my part of the argument, leaving two for rebuttal and leaving the other half for counsel for the co-defendant. I think I need to start here with the issue of plain error because it is not really helpfully treated in the briefs, I think. Plain error comes into question on the sentencing issues. And I think actually the answer is very simple because plain error requires an error that is plain that affects substantial rights. And when the judge gives his little colloquy about whether Brooks has a right to appeal, I think it's very clear that the judge thinks that the sentencing issues have a substantial effect on his sentence, and therefore an error in analyzing the sentencing issues does affect his substantial rights. And I think that that's very clear from the record.
Could I ask you about the appeal waiver? We have this case, Arias Espinoza, where the court said to the defendant, you may have a right to appeal. And based on the word may, the whole case, the decision seemed to turn just on the use of the word may. He said, well, that wasn't enough to cancel the prior waiver. So when I read the court's statement in this case, it seemed certainly to have as much equivocal type language, even at the end of his little statement. He says, so anyway, there was an appeal waiver. I've now informed him of that. He may come to a different conclusion, and you know, I'm sure you can talk to him about that as well. So why isn't the district court's equivocal statement on that point mean that the appeal waiver remains in effect?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you read the whole range of cases, starting with Buchanan and the other cases, it's clearly a range, and this court has to make value judgment about where the line is. And I think in this case that it's clearly, I mean, it's not as crystal clear as it was in Buchanan, but I don't think it's as ambiguous as any of the other cases where this court has found that the appeal waiver stands. The judge's statement about Mr. Brooks' right to appeal was far more specific than Arias Espinoza or any of the other ones. He specifically talks about the effect of the safety valve decisions and that he ought to be able to appeal those. It isn't the same sort of statement in the other cases where the judge says...
isn't there... There's a lot of cases that says that... the appeal waivers don't apply, which I guess you haven't invoked, but don't apply when you have an illegal sentence, right?
Correct.
And I'm not sure what a legal sentence means, but here we have a sentence that was apparently imposed mandatorily but on erroneous grounds.
I think that's correct.
Is your argument?
Yes.
Why wasn't he saying that essentially? I mean, why don't those two things tie together?
Well,
what he's basically saying is, if I'm wrong, then the whole sentence is just wrong.
Well, that certainly is one way to interpret what the judge was saying. Hmm. And therefore, there would be no waiver of the appeal on that ground. Hmm. I think that's consistent with Judge Kaczynski's concurrence in, what was it, Schumann, about the difficult situation that the district court is in trying to explain the complexities of whether you have a right to appeal or not. So I don't know what he meant, but he might have meant that, or he might have been telling Mr. Brooks he had a right to appeal, even though there was an appeal.
I thought the judge was just stating his understanding that this was included in what was preserved for appeal.
That might very well be, Your Honor.
Since he has a right to appeal the legality of if his sentence is outside the bounds of the agreement, and since this, if he's wrong about this, this would put it outside the bounds of the agreement, was understanding of the district judge's understanding that this is appealable.
That may have been what the judge was saying, Your Honor. It's a little bit difficult.
So let's say that's what he's saying.
Yes.
What does that do on appeal.
I think.
I mean, it's not a vitiation of the waiver, it is the judge's interpretation of the waiver, and does that mean that since that would have been, since this was the district judge's interpretation of the waiver, that was a reasonable way the defendant could have interpreted it, and that we therefore should interpret it that way, isn't that what you would say?
And review the safety valve decision on the merits, yes. I think that you get there either way. Certainly, Mr. Brooks was left.
It's a much easier way for you.
Well, I guess that's right, Your Honor, it is. And certainly.
You can ride on the coattails of the district judge, right?
Is there a case that says that? I mean, all the cases I saw seem to suggest that unless the court is pretty clear, then it's not vitiated. The appeal waiver remains in place. What case are you
relying
on?
Well, no, I think those are two different issues because the appeal waiver only applies to appeals that you can waive and not to appeals that you can't waive.
Well, it's not a question of can't. The point is he didn't waive.
Right, that you don't in the ordinary course appeal. You don't waive your right to appeal an illegal sentence.
And so what's an illegal sentence? Is any time a district court makes an error, is that make the sentence illegal, in your view?
No, I don't think it's that broad. I think it's...
Oh, really? So what is it? What makes it illegal?
Well, in this case, it would be applying the wrong standard to the safety valve.
It's position. Essentially applying a mandatory sentence when it shouldn't have been meant a
Correct.
Mandatory sentence.
So is there a case that says that class is illegal and other errors are not, or what are you relying on?
Yes, there are, and I can't bring the citation to mind, but absolutely, that is my understanding of the law.
That what makes it illegal? Could you just serve in general to characterize what is it that makes a sentence illegal and not just an error?
This sentence would be illegal because he was sentenced to a mandatory minimum sentence when he shouldn't have had a mandatory minimum.
And what makes that illegal? Because I'm not understanding the difference.
It wasn't illegal in the sense that it was an authorized sentence within his maximum, and he could have been sentenced to.
Yes, he could have.
But
yes.
Not mandatorily.
Correct.
So
the judge could have said, I think he's a bad guy, he needs a 60-month sentence. But that isn't what the judge said. The judge said, he's not a bad guy, and in fact, the whole colloquy at the change of plea where they said, we're going to leave him out of jail, you know, he's not that bad a guy. And so the judge clearly is stating that he would have sentenced him to a shorter sentence if he'd had that choice, but he had to impose a mandatory minimum.
So
everybody at the sentencing sort of says the same thing.
So are you saying there's an error in interpreting the statute and that makes it illegal? So
in applying the statute.
In interpretation. If we said that the district court had not made an error, then the appeal waiver would be in effect. Is that your view?
Well, I guess it's kind of circular because once you review on the merits whether the sentence is an error or not, then we really had our review that we would have been entitled to.
So are you saying that if a defendant has an argument that the district court's interpretation of a statute is erroneous, then the appeal waiver, as long as he frames his argument in that way, then the appeal waiver is not in effect.
I think that's generally correct, yes. And that doesn't apply to, you know, discretionary applications of sentence enhancements and that sort of thing. That doesn't make a sentence illegal.
I think you need the point that this pushes it into a mandatory minimum.
Yes.
Right.
So that's what makes it illegal, not just that the district court made a mistake. And
if it was a guidelines mistake, that would
right, right. No. If it was a guidelines mistake, it would not be an illegal sentence.
So why is that? So if the district court misinterpreted the guidelines and imposed a enhancement that was wrong because of a misinterpretation, you're saying that would not be an illegal sentence?
Well, I guess it depends on what the error was in applying the guidelines. I think it's possible that there is a guidelines error out there that would be an illegal sentence.
I guess I'm still not understanding how to differentiate.
Well, I think that you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis and say what kind of
the
error.
The law is pretty murky, I think.
It is very
murky. And at this point exactly isn't really briefed.
That is correct, Your Honor. That's right.
For the moment, let's assume that we get by the appeal waiver. The government's view is that the firearms standard was wrong, but it's harmless. But I think their position is also that even if it's not harmless, the other ground would have been sufficient to deny him.
I think the factual record on the firearm is much stronger, and I do think that the argument is in the briefs about the facts that Mr. Brooks could rely on on a remand to explain it again to the district court. But full disclosure, I think, is a lot murkier, and I think it's clear that the court looked at the full disclosure incorrectly under Mejia-Pimentel. That the court seemed to believe that the fact that he told two different stories automatically disqualifies him, and that the fact that he told what the court thought was the true story first and the other story second.
I thought the judge just said, look, he hasn't come clean, and he told the two different stories.
But this court's cases are very clear that it's the last story that counts. If you
believe the last story.
Correct.
I think what the judge was saying is, look, you know, we don't know what the truth is.
I thought our case law, there's a case called Sheshthra. Have you looked at that?
Yes.
I thought that it's the closest one to this one, and it seems to say it isn't necessarily the last story. It's as long as he has one true story.
Well, that...
Which is what your situation is.
That is true. Well, it's also his last story in this case. One true story, I guess it depends on what the dispute is over. Either one is correct. You just have to come forth once with the whole story. And what I think the
even
judge...
Even if you then lie at trial. Is that exactly what happened in Sheshthra?
Yes, but...
It's a strange rule, but it seems to be the rule.
It does. And this case...
But how do we know? How does the judge know whether there is one true story? There could have been two false stories, right? And he's saying, I don't know. The guy hasn't come clean. He gives two different stories. I can't tell that he's come clean. It's his burden. It's his burden, and he hasn't met it. Why isn't that what's going on here?
Well, because I don't think that's what the judge says. I think the judge gets to do that. I think the judge gets to look. Mr. Brooks' story here is that I told the whole story at trial. That's clearly what his attorney says at sentencing. That is the whole story. I said it all at trial. I was cross-examined. That's the truth. Then I think the judge is permitted to look at that and say, just taking that series of statements, does that fulfill the safety valve requirement? I don't think the judge looked at it that way, just like he didn't look at the gun under the safety valve standard. I think that the judge was saying, I look at all of his statements together to see whether the totality is truthful. And that clearly is not what this court
is. I thought he said even more distinctly that because he lied at trial, that's the end of it.
Well, yes, but he gets there by saying he told a different story earlier than he told a different story at trial. Therefore, he can't get it.
You've used 13 and
yes,
a half
I've
minutes.
Yes, I've used way more than my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Darla Mondew for Attorney Corey Gresham, who is a co-defendant of Mr. Brooks. And Your Honors just heard a very important fact, which was that at Mr. Brooks's sentencing, he averred that he told the whole truth at Corey Gresham's trial, which at that trial he testified for the defense saying that the whole entire marijuana grow is mine. Mr. Gresham was merely a visitor here from Georgia.
But the jury didn't believe it and the judge doesn't believe it, so what's the problem?
They didn't believe it because the statement that he inculpated himself at the interrogation with TFO Carson came in. So what reasonable jury would listen to a co-defendant taking the responsibility for all of it? Honestly, he said he told the truth. And then faced with a statement coming in from the investigator.
So is your argument it shouldn't have come in?
I'm sorry?
So what is your argument? That it should, the other, the earlier statement shouldn't have come in?
That the motion to suppress the statement was clear error, the denial of the motion to suppress. And because that is mostly a credibility determination, which the magistrate judge and the district court judge both believe the officers, we have to look at a little bit of other evidence, testimony that came in that disputes whether Corey said it or not. And that entails, when was Miranda given? Do you believe Carson, that he gave it at the inception of the interview?
It's not us, right? I mean, you know, this is why we have district judges. That's why we, you know, we're not there. We didn't.
That's true.
So we have a factual finding. What do we do with that? The judge said it was given. You know, the officer said, I forgot when I at the outset that the FBI prefers a written waiver. And then I remembered at the end, so I got him to sign the card at the end, but I gave him the warning at the beginning. Judge believed it. What? How do we go behind that?
Because the judge is, there's a presumption against the waiver, so you got to look.
You have a finding. You know, this, you know, presumptions are there until there's a finding. Once there's a finding, there's a finding. What do you do with the finding?
You appeal it on clear error that finding was in error based on the fact that his because there was no corroboration that he gave it in the beginning. Trooper Ingram was there.
Well, you don't need corroboration. Why do you need corroboration?
Well,
you have a witness. A witness testifies. The judge believes the witness. Isn't that how things work? I can't imagine what else you want.
Well, when you're starting with the foundation, there's a presumption against the waiver.
There's a presumption, and the judge then finds the witness telling the truth. That overcomes the presumption. So, it's over.
Because there was no corroboration of that.
You say that, but where is the requirement of corroboration? Is there some rule that says if there's a presumption, you need corroboration? I've never heard of it.
No, Your Honor. I'd like to move on to the search warrant, if I may.
Okay.
That was a clear error, too.
Yeah, but you have the same problem again. I mean, they said they smelled it, and you're saying they didn't, and you shouldn't have believed them.
Well, what I'm saying is they omitted from the search warrant that Trooper Ingham testified that on four or five occasions he detected no odor whatsoever.
So what? I mean, you know, the fact is if you detect odor once, that's enough. That tells you there's marijuana in there. The fact that the wind is blowing in a different direction, or, you can't smell it every time.
But he didn't report that to the magistrate judge. And if you
why would
flight,
he?
Because it is
he material. Didn't report that the sky is blue or the...
It's material to her decision.
Why?
On whether there needed to be more. We've got five times he didn't smell anything, Trooper Ingram. We have one time that Trooper Young didn't. And
well, let's say somebody's on a stakeout and says, I watched that corner for 5 days, nothing happened. And then one time I saw the defendant and another person sitting there exchanging money and a package. Why is it relevant that for 5 days nothing happened in that corner? Lots of stuff doesn't happen in an investigation. That's why we have people watching and investigating until they find it. But the fact is that you smell it once, the smell doesn't come from nowhere. And in this case, twice, right?
Trooper Ingram once, Trooper Young once.
Okay, so that's twice.
Six times, no. Anyway, Your Honor, moving on to...
I mean, it's not like a police dog where you say, well, this police dog is reliable, and then he has five false negatives, or five false positives, rather. They just said, well, several times we didn't smell it. Lots of stuff.
Well, then there
happen.
Also was the inclusion of the... unknown confidential informant, undocumented confidential informant who said that Mr. Gresham had been selling drugs in Anchorage. That was part of his affidavit. That certainly should not have been included in there. It wasn't a reliable. All it did was bolster their case. And I draw your honor's attention.
I don't even remember this argument. Was this argument made in the briefs?
I'm sorry?
What? I don't remember this argument, this last one that you're just mentioning now.
I don't believe that.
You raised it in your brief. You did.
I don't believe that trial counsel specifically argued about that. No.
And I don't think you argued about it either, so let's forget about it. So.
One issue that has had a little bit of activity lately is the statute. I don't know how to pronounce the case. Is it Elaine? The new United States Supreme Court case that says the drug quantity has to be lodged in the indictment. Well, in Mr. Gresham's case, yes, it was. It said more than 100 plants. But, and trial counsel did argue at sentencing that even though the jury's verdict came back with 100 plants, the sentencing guidelines define a plant with a root ball. And the government did not meet its burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that.
But the jury was finding it with regard to, again, to a mandatory minimum, right?
Yes.
And that's the provision that applies with regard to the mandatory minimum, which doesn't have this definition.
It does not, no.
All right, so what's the problem?
Well, because at sentencing, the judge requested briefing on the root ball issue. The government didn't.
I know, but I'm wondering what its relevance was. If the jury found it, and the jury's finding was itself sufficient to compel a mandatory minimum, what did the rest of it matter for?
Because, Your Honors, it makes the dichotomy of, like in Robinson, where the defendant pled, he was given the benefit of counting root balls. In a jury finding, in new cases now, when the government alleges the quantity, like they did in this case, the 100 plants, there are still going to be the dichotomy between what the sentencing guidelines define a plant to be for sentencing, which they're advisory, but they still are applicable, and the defendant who gets sentenced for 100 plants that aren't defined with root balls.
And so?
Well, that totally is something that's going to be even, not only is it important in this case, because counsel argued there was only 46 root balls, it makes it that either the statute's going to have to give, and
more likely, the statute's the statute, so the guidelines provision is there for a different reason, right?
It's there for the defendant who pleads to manufacture marijuana without a quantity, because if that defendant's quantity is 100, then he gets the mandatory minimum. If his quantity is 50, he gets to be sentenced under the amount of plants that had root balls.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Joanne Farrington, appearing for the government in Mr. Brooks' appeal.
Anything you heard this morning wasn't adequately covered in your brief?
I believe it was, with a couple of points that I'd like to make in response to.
So your answer is yes, there is.
The answer is yes, with the exception of a couple points that I'd like to answer in response to questions that were raised by the court. First of all, an error doesn't make a sentence illegal. Because this wasn't briefed, I don't have a citation for the court, although I'd be happy to provide one. But in general, an illegal sentence is one that exceeds a statutory range.
This is kind of like an Elaine problem. It didn't exceed the statutory range, but it turned something into a mandatory minimum that wasn't one, arguably.
It did, but that's not an unusual thing. The judge makes all sorts of rulings in the course of sentencing a defendant, and if the defendant has waived his right to appeal those rulings, the fact that the judge makes errors.
But he's not usually making them about statutes. He's usually making them about about guidelines. And it's, and the consequence isn't to make something a mandatory minimum that isn't, I mean, it's not to express his discretion, but to eliminate his discretion.
Well, as I said, this is not an issue that was raised by the defendant on appeal.
Well, but it does seem to be what the judge was essentially saying. I mean, that's what was bothering him.
I believe it's completely unclear what the judge was saying, frankly. It's not clear whether he was saying, I think he has a right to appeal this issue, or maybe he has a right to appeal, though the government can disagree.
He wasn't saying maybe.
He's saying it seems to me,
which
I think is an equivocal statement on its face.
What's equivocal about it? It seems to him. It's his interpretation of the situation.
That is equivocal.
And he talks about the Ninth Circuit disagreeing with his rulings, which can only happen if there is an appeal, you know, so, you know.
And at the same time...
We don't usually sort of disagree in the abstract.
Within the same breath, practically, he also twice tells the defendant that he has waived his right to appeal. What he's saying
is... He says there was an appeal waiver. He doesn't say you have waived your right to appeal. He said there was an appeal waiver, but I think that the Ninth Circuit would find that you could appeal this.
And that, I think, is equivocal. That's expressing his opinion, his thought that maybe there is a right to appeal. And
he's
frankly,
just making
I think
a statement, a factual statement in the plea agreement. There is a plea waiver, an appeal waiver.
Just for clarification, so there's one question as to whether what the district court said was enough to vitiate the appeal waiver. Does that matter at all if the defendant had argued that the sentence was illegal? Does it matter whether the district court said anything or not? In other words, is there a per se rule? Again, this issue, so far as I know, was not briefed. But is there a per se rule that a defendant can always appeal an illegal sentence regardless of an appeal waiver?
I do not have the case at my fingertips, but my understanding is that is one of the exceptions to
so it doesn't really matter if
this was an illegal sentence,
right? Then it wouldn't matter what the district court said.
You can't waive your right not to receive an illegal sentence.
Okay.
This, however, was a legal sentence. It was within the statutory range. In fact, it was. And Judge Kuczynski, you suggested that perhaps it violated the plea agreement, but the plea agreement, in fact, said that it was a range up to 40 years with a 5-year mandatory minimum. That's at page 32 of the excerpt of record. So not only was it within the statutory range, but he was expressly on notice in his plea agreement that was going to be the potential sentence. Beyond that, unless there are other questions.
But only if a safety valve doesn't apply.
You'd like me to address?
No, I mean, clearly in the plea agreement, the assumption, it couldn't have said you're going to get a mandatory minimum even if the safety valve applies. It didn't say that.
The safety valve question isn't addressed in the plea agreement.
Okay.
The range of sentences to which Mr. Brooks was exposed was.
Well, I would like to know whether, let's assuming we get beyond the waiver.
Okay.
Do you know the Shestra opinion or whoever one says that?
Yes, I have read that. Yes.
Why isn't it controlling on the question of the proffer?
Well, I think that the basic standard under the...
Controlling, at least to the degree that the judge applied the wrong standard and it ought to go back for him to decide essentially whether he ever told the truth at either stage.
I think that what the judge said is, you didn't tell the truth. You lied.
Only at the trial. He kept saying, at the trial you lied, right?
That's right.
And he never considered whether he had told the truth earlier.
Which is the only statement that Mr. Brooks relied on at sentencing. He said, I told the truth at trial, and therefore I told the truth to the government before sentencing, and therefore I'm entitled to the safety valve. He never suggested, in fact, he expressly rejected any argument that he told the truth earlier than that. I don't think it was up to the court to speculate that, well, maybe he was telling the truth before, but maybe not. Maybe he told part of the truth, maybe not. It's up to the defendant to make that argument. It's his burden to persuade the judge that he's entitled to the safety valve.
So your position then would be that the fire, the whole firearms thing doesn't matter?
Exactly. The whole firearms thing does not matter. Either one, either of the two, either his failure to provide the government with a full and truthful statement about his role in the offense before sentencing, or his constructive possession of the gun would defeat the safety valve.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Kyle French from the United States with regard to the Gresham matter.
Mm-hmm. Anything you heard that wasn't adequately covered in your brief?
Yes, your question, Your Honor. Your question was about the officer forgetting to initially give the Miranda rights in terms of the written document and getting a signature on a document. One thing that
everybody... You don't think that was covered in your brief, huh?
It was covered, but an aspect wasn't, Your Honor, and that's the officer works for the Anchorage Police Department, and they have a policy to record all interviews. So that explains why he would have forgotten in this case.
Well, the only thing that I'd like to know a little bit about is the business about the 100 plants.
Certainly.
Is the guidelines of the statute inconsistent with each other? I mean, is your position that with regard to the 100 plants for the mandatory minimum, they don't have to have root balls? They can just be what? I mean, how do you know if it's a plant?
Well, the statute doesn't define what a plant is.
Okay.
And the jury is left with the common knowledge that's provided to it from day-to-day experience, as well as, for example, in this case, an expert identifying that this was marijuana, pictures provided to them identifying marijuana.
Well, we know it was marijuana. The question is whether there were 100 plants.
Marijuana plants, specifically. They are not seeds. They are not a different kind of plant.
Did somebody testify that there were 100 of them?
There was testimony specifically about root balls. Mm-hmm. Officer Carson, on direct, was asked about how he counted the particular number of plants in this case. Officer Carson said, well, it's different in the federal and the state system. And on the site, we were reminded, myself being a state person, that we have to separate and count the root balls. Because in a state system, we go by weight, not root balls. So we did that in this case. Well, how many were there, Mr. Carson? Right on the property and evidence form, there's a separate entry that says 190 plants. That is separate from other entries that talk about marijuana and talk about other types of marijuana plants and being located in other locations. They made a specific entry for that count of 190, and that reflects how many root balls were actually there.
When I looked at the transcript, in addition to having extensive testimony about root balls, there were also apparently photographs of plants with root balls. I mean, that wasn't really briefed. I didn't see that in the brief. Was there some question about all of that evidence and testimony?
In terms of admissibility, no, Your Honor. There weren't, I can't recall, but there's over 300 exhibits in this particular case. There's a large number of pictures of plants in various stages of formation. Whether the pictures depicted every single one of the 190, I don't know. One critical factor in this case, though, for the court is the jury, in fact, made two special verdicts, one for manufacture and one for conspiracy with intent to manufacture over many months from April 2010 to November 30th, 2010. The law enforcement could have went into that house and not found a single plant, and we still could have convicted Mr. Gresham for conspiracy of intent to possess and manufacture, distribute marijuana of 100 or more plants. So, for example, say that you have a situation where the marijuana grow has just stripped out all their plants, set them up for resale. They don't have anything currently growing, but they have a warehouse, 3,000 square feet with tons of little pots, tons of equipment, tons of supplies, records of how many they produced over time, of watering, such as in this case. A jury could hear all that evidence and say, yeah, between April and November, we find beyond a reasonable doubt that there was 100 or more plants. So you have a special verdict not just with the manufacturing and how many plants are physically present, but you also have a finding with regard to 100 or more plants with regard to the conspiracy. So that makes this particular issue easy for the court. in terms of identification of the number of plants, because it includes more than just the plants that were present for purposes of the conspiracy finding.
Okay, thank you. You may just take a minute for a rebuttal if you wish.
Your Honor, I think you both addressed all the issues.
That answer didn't answer the question about the difference between the statute and the sentencing guidelines. And it obviously concerned the district court because he asked for briefing on it. And the United States said they weren't going to present an expert to show how many root balls. The testimony at trial does not show 190 plants with root balls. Some were, there were cuttings, there were babies, there were, the total number that trial counsel counted was 46, Your Honors. And I submit on that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so I'll argue with Sam Smith. We'll hear argument next in Native Village of Point Hope versus EPA.